When I got the call from Tom Langer at BAE and he asked me to apply for the vice president position, my exact words to him were, I have no business applying for that job. And he said, yes, you absolutely do. You get promoted into a management role because of the way you succeed in those individual contributor roles. And then once you get into a management role, if you want to get up to be a director or a vice president or executive, there's no possible way you're going to get promoted to being the vice president by doing the best job you can at processing visit requests, right? I treat every security problem just like I treat every chronically ill client. And it's find the source of the illness or problem. Don't treat the symptom.
Welcome to Secure Access with John Dillard, your front door to the future of compliance, security, and tech. Powered by Sign-In Solutions, we bring you bold conversations with industry leaders who are shaping how organizations protect people, data, and spaces. If you're serious about smarter, safer access, you're in the right place. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, John. Pleasure to be here.
It's good. And I think last time we talked, I want to say it was probably 4 or 5 years ago. Is that about right?
I actually think it was when I first started with SAIC. So that would be 5 years in October.
It's been a notorious run. You've been in Washington Exec a couple times, and you've had some, I think you were on the board of NCMS and you were doing NDIA at the time, but I think you've managed to extract yourself from those roles, which is a lot of extra work. I don't blame you.
I have managed to find plenty of successors that can do a better job than me. So yes, absolutely. Sure.
Well, listen, I love to start these conversations just by finding out a little bit more about how you got into security in the first place, because I have found that the journey of everyone, and you know, you've watched some of the podcasts, I think it's fascinating, almost always unintentional. Yes. Nobody expects to be here. So tell me a little bit more about how you got here. What's the backstory?
Yeah, I always say that people get into industrial security either by being voluntold or by being in the military, which is kind of voluntold as well, right? There's really never any in between. Nobody ever says, I want to be a facility security officer when I grow up. You know, ask any 4 or 5 year old, that's not on their radar. So I was in the voluntold bucket. And I actually started out in human resources. I was an intern for a few years, and then I went full-time in human resources as an HR coordinator. And then one day, my supervisor came to me and said, hey, our FSO is going to be moving into the human resources department. Would you like to be her backup? She can't take a vacation. She's the only person in the company, and we need someone to be her backup. And being 21, 22 years old, my first question was, do I get my own office? Because at the time I was in a cubicle and I didn't like it. And my boss said, yes, you would get your own office. And I said, I would love to work in security. So I was in AFSO for about 3 months. And then
For those who are not deep industrial security, that's Assistant Facility Security Officer. I may do that a couple of times.
I will make sure I spell out the acronyms. But I was an assistant FSO for a few months, and then the FSO went on her own way, and they had an opening for the role to be full-time. So I went into it full-time, and I wore 2 hats. It was a small company. So also in security, in addition to being voluntold, you often wear 2 hats, especially in the smaller companies. So I was HR and I was security. Long story short, Northrop Grumman bought our company, and a director at Northrop came to me and said, Michelle, you're going to have to make a decision. Northrop's big. You're either going to have to be human resources or you're going to have to be security. What's it going to be? And my passion and my heart really was in HR. I love helping people. But at the same time, I thought that I could move up in my career a lot faster if I chose the security track, because there's a lot less competition in industrial security than there is in human resources. And I chose security and never looked back. I eventually made my way up just by being a facility security officer. I was a facility security officer at BAE Systems and then moved to a company called American Systems for about 10 years. And then got the call from BAE from my mentor, Tom Langer, and he said, we have a vice president opening and we really want you to interview. made it to BAE, and then about 5 years ago, transitioned from there to SAIC.
I just want to be clear to everybody who's listening. You are the CSO of one of the most high-profile defense organizations in the world. And you started out as an intern doing something else.
I do. That's 100% right, yes.
I mean, it's a pretty remarkable story. And I'm just curious what CSO Michelle would go back and tell intern Michelle, who probably, I'm guessing, would not believe you if she said, hey, I'm going to be chief security officer at this place.
Absolutely. In fact, at the time when I was an intern, my goal was to be an HR generalist. Like, that was where I aspired to be, maybe a recruiter. But I will tell you, I have suffered from imposter syndrome my entire life, my entire career. And I made that summary sound really easy, but there are a lot of struggles in taking on the roles. I made plenty of mistakes, and I had a lot of very well-intentioned people pushing me along all the way. The director at Northrop Grumman, she happened to be a security director. And when she said, you need to make your choice, she buttered me up a little bit because she said, by the way, if you choose security, I could really see you being a director of security at Northrop Grumman one day. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what are you talking about? That's ridiculous. When I got the call from Tom Langer at BAE and he asked me to apply for the vice president position, my exact words to him were, I have no business applying for that job. And he said, yes, you absolutely do. I know you could do the position. And by the way, I'm retiring in 3 years and you would be in line to replace me in 3 years' time. And I thought he was crazy. But if it wasn't for those people pushing me and believing in me, there's absolutely no way I'd be here.
That's awesome. And I've met Tom a couple of times. Really interesting guy, has probably forgotten more about security than anybody I've ever met. How important was that for you, specifically somebody who was a career specialist, sort of take that step and say, you absolutely can do this job?
When Tom, in fact, it was funny. My mentor at the time was a director at Northrop Grumman. And I called him and I said, Tom Langer just called me and said he really wants me to interview for this position. What do I do? And he looked at me and he goes, you say yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Tom, for those of you who know Tom, I mean, he is a legend in the industry. He was one of the very first people to chair the NISPAC. He helped author the original NISPOM. He's a legend and a god in a lot of ways to us in security. So getting that call was a true honor, I will just say. And it blew me away. And I will tell you, the imposter syndrome was very strong getting that call.
Awesome. And since you've taken on the CSO role, Michelle, what have been key moments for you? I think this has now been 3 or 4 years that you've been in this role. So what have been the highlights or key stories that sort of jump out at you as key things that you appreciate about the role, or were sudden moments of recognition of where you were or the scope of the impact that you might have?
So I did eventually end up replacing Tom at BAE. I was the most senior security vice president in BAE, working in the headquarters. My main job was to be the liaison between DCSA, DSS at the time, and our foreign parent. So learning,
which is the federal agency that governs all industrial security policy for any company that touches aerospace and defense, for sure.
Absolutely. It was the Defense Security Service at the time, DSS, and now it's DCSA. But I was the main liaison between our foreign owner and then DCSA and then us. And I was the go-between to make sure that there weren't any foci, which is foreign ownership control and influence issues between the two. But I was 6 months into that role already trying to do as good of a job as Tom Langer, which is impossible. I mean, you just can't fill his shoes. So I had to figure out how to navigate that role in my own way. And I was about 6 months in when COVID hit. So having to pivot quickly, learning that new role, and then helping the company with a worldwide pandemic was definitely a first, definitely an eye-opener. At the time, we had 800 employees all over the world that were stranded. Remember, they were closing the airspaces. People couldn't get home. We had about 2 weeks to get 800 people home fast. We were working 14-hour days, 7 days a week, and being thrown into that baptism by fire was huge. And that was extremely, extremely eye-opening. through that process, through the pandemic, working from home, doing a remote role, being a global CSO and doing a remote role from home. I mean, quite eye-opening, right? And that was right when the SCAC opportunity came.
Yeah.
So making that pivot away from a BAE foreign-owned company into SCAC, where our footprint is mainly in the domestic U.S., having to learn a whole new team, having to build a team really too in the midst of COVID, I think all of that was huge.
Awesome. And in, as you think about the leadership journey specifically and what it means to be in this role, I mean, obviously being an individual contributor over many years in a variety of different capacities, you're probably doing a lot of the legwork yourself. And I think the last time we talked about shifting to achieving more through others as opposed to being an individual contributor and how you do that. And as I was thinking about this podcast, I was reading your Washington exec write-up from last year, and your leadership mantra was, what got you here won't get you there, which reminds me of, and I'm curious if that is a reference to Marshall Goldsmith's book. And if you haven't read that book, I definitely would read it. But if it's not, that's okay. I'm just curious what that means to you in the context of getting somewhere that doesn't apply the same skills
of
the ones that got you into the role.
It's one of my favorite things to say to the people I'm mentoring. And no, I didn't get it from that book. I don't know where I picked that up. I'm sure it was a TED Talk. It might have been a Brené Brown thing. It wasn't that particular book, but I loved that quote. And I feel bad I can't attribute it to the proper person, if that is the proper person. But it's just that. So you're exactly right. I was an individual contributor for many, many years. I was the facility security officer. I was the ISM, which is the person that maintains the classified computers. I was the HR specialist. I was the HR generalist. I did a lot of the work myself. And I got recognized based off of that work that I was doing myself. However, you get promoted into a management role because of the way you succeed in those individual contributor roles. And then once you get into a management role, if you want to get up to be a director or a vice president or executive, there's no possible way you're going to get promoted to being the vice president by doing the best job you can at processing visit requests, right? You have to show the value that you bring to the table. You have to show that you're a business enabler. You have to show that you can manage from the 10,000 foot level, not the 1 foot level. And so many people get wrapped up in that. And I see that so often in these new managers where they know that they can do it better than the employees under them. So they don't want to delegate. They end up doing the management work and then doing the individual contributor work together because they think that's the best way it should be done. And then they get so wrapped up and so stressed, they can't rise above everything to be able to think with that broader mindset and get into those higher level promotion roles. Yeah. I've also talked to a lot of people on the flip side where I'm actually mentoring a person right now and he loves his job. I don't think I've ever met anyone who loves their job so much. He absolutely loves everything he does. And he asked me, you know, how do I become a vice president? And he's probably in his mid-30s. He's never managed before because he loves what he does. And I had to really sit down with him and say, do you want to be a vice president? I don't think you do. If you do that, you can't do all these things that you love every day. And you are so extremely happy giving back and doing these things. I said, I think you might be miserable. So I kind of walked him through a day in the life of a vice president and what that means and how, you know, you're sitting on Zoom for 10 hours straight in meetings and you don't actually get to do the work that you had a passion for. And I think he was mortified into the conversation. But I gave him that as homework. I said, next time we talk in a few weeks, come back and tell me if that's really what you think you want. I think people like the dollar signs, but they're not necessarily fulfilled by it. So you really got to look at it from both ways.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great story. Shifting gears just a little bit about the CSO role in general, and this not just in your CSO role, but in general across companies that employ a CSO, and maybe they also have a CISO, Maybe they also have a chief legal officer. There's usually a grab bag of stuff around security. Where do you think the CSO role fits in most organizations of some size? I mean, let's assume we're talking about fairly large companies like yours. And how do you see companies maybe messing this up? I mean, where should it sit, and where do companies commonly make a mistake in how they sit in the organization?
I'm going to give you a lawyer answer. It depends. And I really think it depends on the company, and it depends on the people in the company. The chief security officer, or the security office in my career, I've reported to legal, I've reported to HR, I've reported to IT, I've reported to contracts. And in every one of those areas, it worked. And it's because the company made it work that way. I think the biggest thing is leadership needs to make it a point to listen to security. And no matter where security is sitting in the organization, if the security has a seat at the table, and if senior leadership is actually listening to what we have to say, I think it can go anywhere. I love the SAC structure. We actually restructured after I came here. And at first, when we restructured, a lot of people were saying, Michelle, this doesn't make any sense. Other CSOs had said to me, I would never report to a CIO ever. And I report to the CIO right now. And under our CIO, we have the CISO, the Chief Information Security Officer. We have me, the Chief Security Officer. We have the whole IT team. And we have the Chief Data Officer. And we have the Vice President of Facilities. We are called Infrastructure Enablement, that team. And it actually works quite well. And the reason why it works quite well is my boss has made it a very specific point to say from day one, he goes, Michelle, I'm not the Chief Security Officer. I'm not going to speak on behalf of you. I'm not going to do anything from a security standpoint that goes contrary to security. We have really become a partnership, and he listens, which is exactly what's needed. And he never sacrifices IT for security. A lot of CSOs don't want to report to the CIO because they think the CIO just wants to do everything technical and doesn't want to care about security. But because he has me, he has the CISO, and he has facilities, which is SCIFs. You know, he has like the main security footprint for the company, so he gets it. And I think it does work. There's also the chief risk officer who in SAC reports into legal. The ethics reports into legal. So I also make it a point to meet with them one-on-one at least monthly. We touch base. What's going on in your space? Hey, this is what I heard. Hey, how can we collaborate better? And if you're not putting in that effort and doing that work, I don't think it would work at any company. But we really do work hard to partner.
Yeah. And that's a recurring theme on this podcast that seems to come up in every single conversation, is the importance of these partnerships across organizational boundaries, because security is so many different things. The other thing that tends to come up is the problem that the definition causes. I mean, security... I mean, all these terms are sort of invented: cybersecurity, information security. There's industrial security. Obviously, you have visitor management, you have facilities, you have risk, most of which doesn't help us. This is language that doesn't really solve the problem of, you know, really addressing the fundamental issue, which is protecting the company, its people, its assets, its customers from whatever risks or threats they might be facing. And I'm just curious if that's been your experience. And you come from an industrial security background. And, you know, the cyber and information security folks tend to talk a certain way and think about certain things in a certain way. The facilities folks are very much the same way. What are some strategies that you found effective in breaking down some of those vocabulary issues of just thinking about the words differently so that you're all communicating about the same things the same way?
I don't know if I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to try to answer your question. So I think too often we get hung up in our own stovepipes and we are only looking at things from our point of view. And one of the things that I preach the most, if my team is listening, they're going to roll their eyes when they hear me say this, but I preach this all the time. I say we need to think about SOY, S-O-Y, and it stands for SAIC first, others second, yourself last. And when you're thinking about a business problem or you're trying to make a business decision, oftentimes people do yes. They think of themselves first, how it's going to impact them, then others, then the company. And if you flip it and you put the company's best interests first in everything you're thinking about, it makes that communicating between the stovepipes so much easier because you're not all looking out for your individual interests. You're all looking out for your company, for SAC's interests. And I find it works so, so much better. So I always seek to listen first and hear the other point of view before I interject and say, well, this is how we may be affected, but how can we merge all of these problems together to do what's best for the company or national security, frankly? I mean, in security, really the end goes first, then soy, right? Because national security is the most important thing. And we always have to serve national security first in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Well, and how is that really shifting just a little bit into how things have changed? I mean, we're talking about how you're kind of operating today, but you know, certainly your experience, my experience, we're in a very different place than we were 20 years ago, 25 years ago. How would you describe, well, let's put it this way. What do you think the most important or impactful change that's occurred in the community over the last 25 years? About maybe with the way you thought about it when you were that intern.
Yeah.
The security environment then versus the one we live in today.
So I really think, and a lot of people may not have really thought of it this way, but when I first started 25 years ago, security was guns, gates, guards, right? And it was pushing paper. You know, we were still getting the clearance validations on those little green slips of paper in the mail. That's how we found out if someone was cleared. And we were pushing paper. It was a secretarial, administrative, heavy duty. When everything changed was Snowden. And when, to me, when everything changed, when DCSA made insider threat programs mandatory. Because when insider threat programs became mandatory, that forced all the other functions by a NISPOM requirement to play a part in security. And that's really when we started getting a seat at the table. And that's really when we got to start talking about the threats that were coming into the company and the things that we could do better from a SOI perspective to work together to solve this national security problem. I saw a huge change. And there was a fight when it first came out. You know, a lot of companies were like, what do you mean that, you know, legal and HR and communications and ethics should all be talking together? This doesn't make any sense. And, you know, there was a lot of pushback from HR. We don't want to tell you what employees are having performance problems. That's our information. Security shouldn't have that. And those walls and those barriers have really been broken down over the past decade since all of that was put in place. And I am really, really seeing a lot better interaction. And we've become stakeholders and business enablers versus admins and secretaries.
Yeah. Well, Tim Wenzel, who was on the podcast 2 or 3 weeks ago, one of the most interesting points he made was the shift from, you know, you think about front desk security and visitor management and perimeter security.
Yeah.
Which usually, you know, you hired Allied Universal or whatever, and you kept them in a box and you didn't really talk to anybody. They made a shift, and he was at Meta at the time, of realizing this is probably the first interaction most people have with our brand.
Yes.
Or, you know, in BAE for you, it was the first interaction that your parent company might have had with your subsidiary company because you've got to handle the visit requests coming in. And just how transformative it was for his security team to realize that they were part of the company serving an important brand and mission purpose, even though, yes, we're doing visitor stuff and we're doing badges, but it's this reflection of the business purpose.
100%.
Really interesting. Yeah.
100%. Yes.
So, well, neat. And in terms of additional things that have changed, that probably put a lot of new hiring requirements on you that made the pool, you know, difficult to navigate. I'll put it that way. In terms of finding people, retaining people, different kinds of skills, people who can even think that way that we just described, where they're thinking about soy or they're thinking about brand first.
Yeah.
How is the landscape changed in terms of talent and retention over the last 25 years?
I will say it's changed dramatically. The past 5 years have been an impossibility COVID really, really, really hurt us. And the reason why is because people love working from home. People love hybrid. And it is very, very, very hard to work from home when you have to work in a SCIF every day. And not only that, but we have had a lot of wonderful, wonderful people, these graybeards that have retired. The Tom Lingers are gone. And we are not replacing the skill set at the rate that they're leaving. So you're having a lot of Gen Xers, you know, stepping into these boomer roles. And we're looking...
Hey, now, you be careful. I'm going to get upset if you don't.
But the Gen Xers are looking behind us saying, wait a minute, where are us? You know, where we were 20 years ago, that pipeline, it doesn't exist. It is really hard to find these younger candidates that want to work in a SCIF, that don't have much remote work opportunities, that these are also individuals, to be completely candid, want to be able to smoke marijuana occasionally, and they can't with the clearance. Right. Believe it or not, that really eliminates a big population. And with this complexity between the state laws being one way and the federal laws being the other, a lot of them, even if they want to get in security, they don't understand that nuance. So we go to pre-screen them when they apply for the jobs, and they just can't get through the pre-screen process because they didn't realize, oh, I shouldn't have been doing that over the past 6 months to a year. So that is really a struggle. I always say that I can teach anybody security, but I can't teach the passion. And you really have to be passionate about the role in order to be taught all of the different nuances. And it's getting harder and harder to find that passion. I will also say a lot of the candidates that are coming to us either have criminal justice degrees or cybersecurity degrees, and think cybersecurity is this big sexy thing where they catch the bad guys and you know, what they see on TV, when in reality you're sitting in a SCIF and you're configuring thousands of different controls and documenting them. And these people are like, wait a minute, this is boring. I don't want to do this. So just struggling through how we make this, how we make this exciting for the younger generations coming up is really a struggle. I will say every single one of my interns that come through, we send them through all the different security departments so they learn all the different aspects. Every single time they all say they want to work on the insider threat team. I can only have so many people working on my insider threat team. I have all these other jobs, and it's so rare that people want to fill those. So it's been a struggle.
It's really interesting that you're not... You know, you might expect that it would be a skills problem and they're not getting trained in the right things. So it sounds like it is as much, if not more, mindset and adaptability to, you know, the kind of unique culture, the subculture of security.
It is. And also, you have to think, a lot of people in national security, a big part of why they're so passionate about it is patriotism.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a top priority for some of these people coming into the workforce. A lot of their priority right now is money. How can I make a lot of money quick? And what jobs pay the best? And oftentimes that's why they end up in cybersecurity, because those are paying really well right now. So you have people that really want that paycheck, but they don't necessarily have the passion, and they get burnout and bored quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of how long they stay, and the burnout and the effect on how long they stick around, what are you seeing in terms of folks who do join, the tenure that they're sticking around in these roles?
So again, I'm going to pick on cybersecurity. So the ISMs, the ISOs, those are the folks that really work on the classified systems, the system admins that work on the classified systems. Gosh, we're lucky if we can keep them 3 years. I mean, that's lucky. A lot of times they just find a opportunity that pays more, or they find an opportunity that's remote. When CMMC started up in CUI, all these alarm bells were going off in my head, because I knew the cleared population had those skill sets, and you can work those jobs remote. You don't have to be in a SCIF. And I was really worried we were going to have this mass exodus. And a lot of ways we did. So I think we are still trying to recover, and we are still trying to get qualified people that are willing to work in that classified aspect. And honestly, John, I think the future and what leaders like me have to start thinking more about is how can we hybridize those roles? How can we split these positions? So 20 hours a week, you're working from home on CMMC stuff. And then the other 20 hours a week, you're in the SCIF working on classified stuff. I think companies could easily do that and flex their people. I think where we struggle is the government customer would have to give us twice the amount of billets in order to do it that way. And that's kind of what we're up against there. But I think we're going to have to get more creative, and we're going to have to change that mentality so that people can flex in and out of a SCIF, because people just don't want to live there anymore.
It's a really interesting problem. And related to what I've been working on at Sign In Solutions too, what we mean by visitor, what we mean by employee, what we mean by facility, it doesn't seem like it remotely resembles what it was 10 years ago.
Absolutely not.
And you think, and I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. I mean, you take, you know, visitor management as an example of, okay, is a visitor a person who's working offsite and is coming in half time to work in SCIFs? Or is it truly only someone who's not an employee of the organization? Or like, what do these words even mean to you anymore? I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, that's kind of a big question. Solve the English language problem around how we talk about this. But what are your thoughts?
Well, the lines have completely blurred. And when CUI started coming up, you know, I would hear other CSOs say, oh, well, we're fine. We have shredders in our facilities and, you know, we're doing this and we've locked the cabinets. And I said, what about the 15,000 people that are working from home and could have CUI? We do have 15,000 offices in a lot of ways. And how do we think about that? And how do we handle that? And I think, you know, 25 years ago, policies were very easy to write because we wrote them within the four walls of our organizations. And now that just doesn't work anymore. There are no such thing as four walls. And visitors to us are non-employees, just to answer that question for you. They come and go all the time. And we have touchdown spaces and things like that, but we would never consider an employee a visitor.
It's not very nice to call them a visitor.
It's not.
I mean, notwithstanding how you might have to handle the procedure. When you're a BAE and handling foci, though, I imagine that was a little bit different.
That was a little bit different. And of course, because even if we had an employee that was a foreign national, we had to treat them like a visitor. They had to be under escort. So yes, with foreign-owned companies, it's a lot different.
One is switch gears and talk a little bit about the threat landscape. Which, and you know, we could probably do 2 hours just talking about this, honestly. But today, I mean, 2025, where we're sitting right now, what are a couple key themes that you see in the threat landscape, especially things that maybe folks are not really thinking about as traditional threats? I mean, when I say threat landscape, what does that mean to you?
I'm going to go back to remote work. I would say that's number one. Because all of these people are coming in remote, they're vetted differently, they're treated differently, they interact differently. It's much easier for a supervisor to notice their employee isn't feeling well or acting different or hasn't shown up to work for a few days when you share an office space with them. But in the remote environment, employees could literally be missing for a week or two before a manager even thinks about it. Usually the red flag is at the timesheet period, right? Oh, well, they didn't execute their timesheet. But not necessarily knowing who these people are all the time, I think is huge. That's huge right now.
And especially as facilities, well, one of the things that I think you and I talked a little bit when we were preparing for this call was the growth in AI and data centers, and specifically that when you have these massive, and you look out, you drive out to, you know, down in Reston in Virginia, and the facilities keep getting bigger and bigger, and the campuses are enormous, they're like small cities. Yeah. And the people moving in and out of those spaces, and the contractors moving in and out of those spaces, the consumption of resources, and just physically land, let's say nothing but energy. What are your thoughts on that particular part of the problem, especially as it relates to these people, and who the heck are they?
There's so many things about AI. I could talk about AI all day, as you said. First of all, with AI, I think when it was, when we first found out about it, and I mean, ChatGPT is now just a household term. It wasn't a year ago. Like, I mean, a year ago, we were just learning what it was. And a year ago, the instant response from all the chief security officers were, well, we're just going to block it. We'll just block it. And that solves our problem. And we don't have to worry about it.
That's usually the go-to for a lot.
We'll just block it. I will say my CIO, I love him because he really does think out of the box, and he's not just thinking about today. He's thinking about 5 years from now. And when this came out, he basically was like, all right, how are we going to embrace this? How are we going to use this? But not only that, but how are we going to do it responsibly? And it goes along with the whole, if you can't beat them, join them thing. AI is never going away. You can't just block it. There are certain tools you can block on your network and prevent them from doing it, but they're just going to get on their cell phones or their personal devices. So we at SCAC, we actually created our own SCAC app that employees can go to and use. We can input proprietary questions to help get answers from, and it's all protected. And it's in our own environment, so we don't have to worry about our proprietary information going into ChatGPT or Grok or things like that. So I think when you see these types of things and you see this new technology, you have to think about how to use it responsibly, how to use it to your advantage, and how also to be very careful with it in that... LinkedIn was very similar. When LinkedIn first came out, a bunch of people were saying, well, I'm just not going to have a LinkedIn profile. That way I'll be safe. And I don't want to put my face out there. That way I'll be safe. And my counter argument to them always was, how do you know if you're being impersonated? You know, if you don't have your profile and claim your space the way you want to display yourself, somebody could very easily come across and create an account that looks just like you, and you'd never know because you don't have an account. So I think AI is very, very similar. And taking it one step further, I think there is this huge race, this information race, this knowledge race. And in a lot of ways, this dovetails into national security. Which country can get the most sophisticated AI the fastest? Because the country with the most knowledge is going to win the cyber war. And we're all racing to build these data centers. But what I'm not seeing is we're not racing to build the critical infrastructure, and we're not racing to build the security around these data centers. And I think it's just kind of been like this haphazard process. I just saw an article in a Northern Virginia magazine talking about Ashburn. I mean, Ashburn, there are data centers popping up all over the place. So much so, the electric companies are starting to go out to the residents and say, be prepared for brownouts. During high peak periods, you may not have the power you need to power your air condition. You know, instead of the 65 degrees you're used to, you may need to have to get used to 72 degrees in your house. So we're not building it smartly. It reminds me of when we build all these houses and neighborhoods and then the highways get clogged.
Yeah.
You got to build the highway first, then the neighborhoods. The data centers are the same way. We need the water. We need the power. And we need to make sure we're doing it smartly by also building in the security.
That's a really interesting question, I would think, for companies like SAIC and other top-tier defense contractors in general that may have important missions that are depending on those data centers to operate effectively. And if they use AI more, that's going to increase. And again, without disclosing anything about SAIC details that are not appropriate to disclose, how's the security team at SAIC thinking about dependence on not just the tools themselves, but the critical infrastructure underlying the tools as you think about the next 10 years and the security infrastructure required to protect the company? As SAIC thinks about its dependence on AI tools and the infrastructure underlying those AI tools, does that change SAI's thinking on its security posture and what it needs to prioritize to protect it?
So I have to be careful in answering this question because my role in SAIC is protecting the internal company. My role is not outwardly facing to our customers. So the aperture that I see is what we're doing to protect our own assets. And I would say we definitely collaborate and talk about these things on a multi-pronged basis. And again, that's why the way our team is structured with the CSO and the CIO and the facilities, those are the types of our everyday conversations of, okay, are we moving to the cloud? Great. If we're having on-prem, how are we securing that building? Do we have, you know, Kube, all those things. But from a customer-facing standpoint, I don't think I can answer that question.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense. Well, cool. Another kind of question on the future of where things are headed right now. You and I talked a little bit in the pre-call about SCIFs. We've talked about SCIFs a number of times.
Yeah.
And one of the interesting connections that we made is that we both knew Sean at Nooks.
Yeah.
For those of you who haven't heard of Nooks, Nooks is a building, a SCIF is a service company. That model is super interesting. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience with the constraints of SCIFs in general and where you see, I mean, SCIFs are certainly part of the problem, but generally sensitive spaces where we have to work and how that has to change over the next 10 or 15 years.
So full disclosure, Nooks is a strategic venture partner with SAIC. I have been working very closely with Sean. And one of the reasons why we decided to invest in Nooks is because they are solving a problem that no one else is. And there are two things with SCIF as a service. First of all, we have a shortage of SCIFs, period. We don't have enough to satisfy the needs of the contracts in the government. And taking it one step further, we now have to be up to these industrial, these ICD 705 directives, which is the intelligence community directives, which say, hey, all the SCIFs that you've been building over the past 20 years, those standards aren't good enough. We need you to upgrade all of these things, and you need to do it in the next 3 years. So industry as a whole and government as a whole is all making this concerted effort to upgrade all their spaces all at once. It's going to take a lot of time and it's going to take a lot of money. And in that process, there are a lot of companies that are not going to be able to have a SCIF because their existing one's going to be under construction and they're going to have nowhere to go. So Nooks, with their model, is they almost look at it as a hotel. You rent the space by the hour versus a long-term lease. And they have, Sean calls it his gym memberships, right? You know, for a low, low price of X, Y, and Z, you can have access to a SCIF for 3 hours a month, you know, at this cost. But it fulfills such a huge need because we aren't having any flexibility right now. And what I always have been saying is that Nooks is an industry agnostic conduit to access classified information. It is going to enable the small businesses and the medium-sized businesses to be able to go and look at that RFP and see if they want to bid on it.
New problem.
And if you're a five-person mom-and-pop shop, you can't build a $50,000 SCIF. You just can't. So being able to have a place to look at RFPs and bid on work, and if you'd happen to win the work, a place to do the work out of, is huge and much, much needed.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And just from your perspective, I mean, from SAIC perspective, if you're engaging with flexible arrangements for a SCIF, how do you think about the policy and governance components of that? So, for example, when somebody comes to visit the SCIF, who is it SAIC that's thinking about, I have to vet that visitor before they enter this third-party UN SCIF, or is that part of what the third-party provider like Nooks provides?
That's a great question. They can do a couple different models. So if you want to be a long-term tenant in their space and you have your own security person in that space doing that vetting, you can choose to do that. But really what they're looking for is that full service model where they do the vetting. They would receive the visit request. They would bring the person in. And, you know, if Sean had a perfect world, he says he wants to have 100 of these facilities all over the country. On any given day, there are people in the air right now above our heads with classified in their briefcase or backpack, flying classified from one SCIF to the other because we don't have a good way to communicate. And if we can change some policies and get better reciprocity and enable this approach, I think it actually becomes a more secure environment than having people be hand carrying and currying this stuff all over the country, because there's no other way to have a classified meeting.
It is really interesting. I mean, and your HR background here is, I imagine, very useful. The analogy that I think of about that is PEOs, for these professional employer organizations. Mm-hmm. When I owned a company called Big Sky that did a lot of classified work, we couldn't use those because it's a third-party employer that delivers the W-2 wages and the benefits to your employees, which is incredible for small businesses because they can't afford to stand up all that infrastructure.
Right.
But if you want to do any classified work, and if you're a small innovator or startup that's invented something cool, the federal government has effectively cut off its access to you because it doesn't have these modular arrangements. So Nook seems like that kind of a solution to me, where it's allowing these small innovators to participate in the ecosystem. What do you think the future of that is? We have this huge startup economy. If you look at these companies that are changing defense right now, are not that old. Palantir and SpaceX, there are certainly some older companies. But what does the future look like for security, defense and security, in order to continue to encourage these small innovators to participate? I mean, Nooks is an example of that. But what else needs to happen to keep security from being an impediment?
We need to be able to make changes to security policy that doesn't take 7 years. It takes about 7 years to make changes to the NISPOM. We need to get away from the security requirements that we used 30 years ago, because once again, security was four walls back then. The walls are down now, and we need to relook at how we do security policy and how we allow the communication of information. Going back to national security, I truly think we are, it's not a nuclear arms race now. It's an AI arms race. Mm-hmm. And if we want to be the best in the world in AI, we have got to get more flexible with our security policies and procedures. We need to be able to attract the best talent. That kind of talent doesn't want to work in a SCIF. We have to be able to attract these AI companies and these highly technological firms, a lot of which are small. And in order to do that, we have to enable them access to the most trusted information. So it's not just policy reform, it's also clearance reform. How can we get these people vetted quicker? How can we do a better job of reciprocity with clearances? And how can we do a better job with reciprocity of spaces? You know, why do we need a SAP-F facility and a SCIF? Why can't SAP information and SCI information be used out of the same facility? There are lots and lots of things like that, that if we really want to do what we say we want to do, we have to back it up in the policy space.
That's it. I mean, obviously, SAIC is to some extent doing its part. I mean, you've engaged in this partnership with Nooks. How much of this is solved in part by tier ones, like big defense contractors, taking the lead? I mean, not waiting for the government to fix it, but just building these relationships with small vendors to help them figure it out, notwithstanding the fact that, yeah, there's got to be policy change. But is there a big role for tier ones to play to make this happen?
I think there is, and without saying any names, one of them really has done a lot with classified cloud and getting to the classified cloud. And Nooks really can't work without that, right? Because the whole point of that, too, is if we get 100 Nooks locations, they all have to communicate with each other some way, and classified cloud is going to be really key to that. And I do think that the big seven can really influence and push things like that in order to be successful. Also, by pushing that and doing things like this, it enables everything to work much more efficient and cheaper. And we won't have to build the government back so much in order to accomplish a lot of these things. So I absolutely think there's a huge role they can play.
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, I mean, this is DCSA and DNI, right?
Yeah.
That have got it seems to me, and this is from watching, you know, folks who have led in the private sector, they will tend to follow the lead if you've got a few companies that will push them. They probably won't do it on their own. That seems to be the track record. But one of the things that they own entirely is vetting. You mentioned talent's come up a couple times here.
Yeah.
You talked about policy changes. We've talked about that being a core part of the problem. Small businesses are particularly affected by it. To what extent is vetting continue? I mean, obviously, there have been efforts to reform public trust and clearances. Every few years, we take a swing at this thing. What are your thoughts on the vetting process, both public trust and for full classified and security clearances, and how that has to change over the next few years in order for any of this to work, even if the other policies are changing?
Reciprocity. I mean, I cannot say that enough. It's a long word, but it's a four-letter word to a lot of us. The IC especially, you know, DCSA has taken on the adjudications of the collaterals, and they've done a very good job at that. And they're quite streamlined. And industry has a really good relationship with DCSA. If we have problems with these collateral clearances, we can typically get it resolved quite quickly. You don't really hear the woes anymore of someone's collateral getting hung up. Where you hear the woes is lack of reciprocity with public trust, because every agency has their own way of processing,
right.
Lack of reciprocity in the IC. And, you know, I would love to see DNI take on the adjudications of all the IC clearances versus each member of the IC doing their own. I think that would go so far. I mean, it's kind of the point of DNI, you know, just to make sure we're all aligned and doing all the same things. I'm sure a lot of people in the IC are going to see me and shake their head and say, Michelle, you just don't get it. But I would love to see that. I would love to see the IC use EAP. You know, a lot of times we're still filling out PDFs. I mean, that takes so much time. Just simple things like that in embracing some of the technology that's already in place. And then, you know, I would love to see DCSA taking on the vetting and adjudication of the public trusts. I think that's really the next way to go. And each agency not having their own vetting criteria. We just all agree on the same vetting criteria and use it. And we've been talking about this for 25 years.
Yeah.
Ever since I got into security, we've been talking about this.
Oh, yeah. Me too. In fact, that's kind of how I got wrapped into this thing in the first place, was security clearance reform during the Afghanistan surge, and I'm still here.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
This is linked to other issues too. I mean, communicating threat information. To what extent is, for example, this kind of continuing problem with communicating threat information to the private sector and across the private sector related to this lack of standards on vetting? Is it because they don't have a standard way of knowing who should be in which channels to get which information? Or is that just another example of another a policy that needs to be streamlined?
I think what you're referencing is the government sharing threat information with industry.
Yeah.
You know, our mandatory insider threat programs, we have to share all of that threat information with the government.
Right.
The problem is once they have that information and that employee moves to another company, that new company isn't necessarily told that information from the government. They have come a very long way in that the government is constantly saying they understand it's a problem and they understand our need to know the information. The hurdles they are trying to get over is the legal battles. It's very
Personal privacy, legal battles.
Yes, exactly. They are really trying to figure out how to work that through legally of what they can and can't share. And I know they're working hard on that. And I think that would be huge. It would be so much better when I get a new hire if, you know, I knew that they were making threats against their coworker when at their former company, and I'm completely blind to all of that right now. I think continuous vetting helps in that we know that if anything new pops up on our employees, that the government's going to ask for that 86. They're going to adjudicate. But at the same time, we have no way of knowing what they're adjudicating or what the issue is. So I would love to see those channels open up more, but I do understand the constraints the government's under.
It is. Although just in the private sector security side of the house, there are a number of things that we have related to background checks and FICO scores and court records that are widely available for private sector appropriate things. It's always been a little bit baffling to me that for privileged individuals, the government feels reluctant or it feels unable to share or have a way of sharing standard information to other privileged parties within a high sensitivity ecosystem. It seems like it should be a no-brainer.
It should be, because it closes the insider threat loop.
Right. Probably the most important gap.
It's one way right now. If it was two way, it would be so much easier. Yeah.
Awesome. Yes. Okay. Now, I like to wrap these conversations up with a few quick rapid fires that are more fun.
Okay.
I haven't completely told you all these in advance, but pithy, short answers. I've never heard you say anything crazy, Michelle. You're always.
You don't know. Well enough.
All right. So first one, weirdest security question you have ever been asked by anyone in your career?
I wouldn't necessarily say weird. I'm just going to say the most annoying. Okay. I'm going to change your question.
That counts.
I always get asked about people's badges. Like, I could be in a meeting with the CEO of the company and the vice president sitting to the right of me will say, why doesn't my badge work today? And it's the same as, you know, if you ask the CEO, why was my paycheck 50 cents different this pay period than last pay period? Those are the questions that frustrate us as security professionals. Ask any security director or vice president. They will tell you they've gotten asked a badge question at least once a week.
Yeah, access control standards are not exactly the best. I have yet to find anybody of any size who doesn't struggle with that very same thing.
And so, yes.
All right. So if you weren't, this is kind of a trick question because you do, in fact, have some side interests that we haven't talked about. But if you weren't doing this all the time, what would you be doing? What would be plan B for Michelle if for some reason you needed to abandon your CSO role?
Yeah, that's. I love that question because it is a huge passion of mine. So I'll get a little vulnerable with this question. So I was diagnosed with chronic Lyme disease about 15 years ago, and it was quite the struggle. I was bedridden for a year or two, and I was able to heal by getting to know and getting cared for by an amazing herbalist who has been treating Lyme disease for 30 years. And she healed me. And not only me, but my 2-year-old son, who was diagnosed at the same time,
oh, wow.
My husband and my stepson, all four of us had Lyme at the exact same time. It was awful. And so when I got better, I said, I want to learn how to do that. And so I went back to school. I got my master's in clinical herbalism. And so, you know, I would love, love, love to be able to help people be healthier and live a better life. Unfortunately, herbalism doesn't pay the way chief security officers
probably
pay.
Not.
So that is definitely a retirement dream of mine. Not something I can do full time right now, but I do have clients. I do treat people here and there, but I would love to make that my full time passion.
That's awesome. That's a great story. Awesome. Follow up to that. What's one thing that the herbal medicine story has taught you that makes you a better CSF?
I treat every security problem just like I treat every chronically ill client. And it's find the source of the illness or problem. Don't treat the symptom. And so many times a problem will come across my desk and I am so inclined to just fix the problem that's right in front of me. But if you ask maybe just 5 or 6 questions, you can actually realize, oh, we're not solving for X. We actually need to solve for Y. And if we solve for Y, we'll never have X again. And it's been a game changer for how I approach my job every day.
That's fantastic. That's a great answer. And I didn't prep you for that one.
Yeah, you didn't prep me for that one.
That was beautiful.
Yes.
All right. Last question on the rapid fire. And that is, if you could choose any leader that you most admire, living or dead, who would that be? Recognizing that I have a feeling you're going to be on some lists like this in the future.
Besides Tom Langer, Teddy Roosevelt, by far. Teddy Roosevelt. I absolutely love and respect him. Speak quietly and carry a big stick for sure. But he also was ever so bold. He never let anybody walk all over him. He loved the environment, loved all things natural. So I love that. But also, much like Teddy, not many people know, he almost died as a child from asthma. he willed himself to health. He basically said, I'm not going to let this asthma get me down. So living with chronic illness and having to still show up every day and willing yourself out of bed some days while also really caring about national security, as did Teddy and his Great White Fleet, I definitely think I model myself after him. Also, what person gets shot in the chest while giving a speech and finishes the speech after getting shot? I could only aspire to be like that.
He's on my biography. This is the year of biographies for me, and I've tried to knock out as many as I can, and I haven't gotten to his yet. There are a couple of phenomenal ones.
His asthma and overcoming that was huge. And he had a lot of personal loss in his life too. So a lot of things about his life resonate with me.
That's awesome. Cool. All right. Well, I will give you the floor for final thoughts as we wrap this up. What's the key takeaway that you want everybody to remember from this conversation as we wrap up?
I will say never, ever, ever let fear get in your way. I have had many instances of imposter syndrome. I've had many instances where my health just wasn't up to the task. And being able to push through all of that, despite how you feel every single day, and still show up and still do what you're passionate about, I would say always, always, always follow that for sure.
Fantastic. Thank you, Michelle. Well, this has been a delight as usual. I hope it won't be the last time we do this. And please don't be a stranger to the podcast. Word of me, for that matter. It's always fun talking to you.
Thank you for having me, John.
You bet. Of course. Anytime.
Thanks for joining us on Secure Access, brought to you by Sinan Solutions. If you found today's conversation insightful, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. For more on transforming compliance, security, and workplace experiences, visit SignInSolutions.com. Until next time, stay secure, stay informed.